Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, June 18th, 2006, and this is show number 48. Happy Father's Day to all our dads out there. I hope everybody who has a dad got a chance to spend a little time with him and thank him for all he's done. Well, it's kind of a good news, bad news weekend. The great news is that Lindsay's home for the summer from college, and that's really exciting for us. The bad news is that means I lost my studio because I had converted her room into my recording studio. So if some little idiot comes in and bothers me in here, you'll know why. No one knows that I'm recording, and they're going to just run in and out of the room now. So I'll do my best to keep them at bay, though. Well, last Sunday afternoon, I had a wedding to go to, so I had to get the podcast done early, and I had to get out of the house by noon. I normally knock it out around, start around 5 and get it done maybe around 9 or 10 at night. And so I got all of the administrivia done the night before, putting the short notes online, saved but not published, uploading all of the pictures, getting the feed all ready to publish. That way, all I had to do Sunday morning was record, add the music, convert to iTunes, convert to MP3 inside iTunes, edit the MP3 in iTunes to add the album art, turn on the bookmarking feature, change the genre to podcast, and then export it back out to where I could upload it to the website. Well, so Sunday morning I recorded, and I got too excited about the digital conference, and I went on for nearly an hour. So when I finished the recording, I only had about 30 minutes to pack and do all those changes to the file. I started the upload to the web, ran around like a crazy person, and got all the packing done. And then we all stood over the Mac just wishing for it to finish faster, waiting for the file to upload. So finally it finishes, and I'm like 10 minutes late now, made the whole family late. And I flipped over to iTunes again to refresh my own subscription to the NoSillaCast to make sure it got up there correctly. And I waited until I saw that little orange spinning arrow had started. Yay, I did it. I got it all done. That was great. So we drove down to San Diego, went to a wedding, relaxed, had a good time, hung out with my cousin sat around, had a glass of wine. And then I go to just check my email, and imagine my chagrin. It's 12 hours later. I'm crawling into bed, and I have two emails, one from Slough and one from my buddy Ron, telling me that the feed was not working. Oh, man. The really tricky part was that I actually messed up two things in the feed. So you mess up one thing, and you go, okay, now it should work, and you spend all your time trying to figure out, did I not mess up the first thing? And it really kind of throws you off track. Turns out I messed up two links, and that took a lot of extra time to fix. Then I'm sitting there going, well, how am I going to tell everybody to just try again? Because if their podcatcher tried, it's not going to be able to get it a second time. It's not going to go look. So I can't tell you, right? I can't send you an email. I can't send you a voicemail. I can't make a recording to tell you, because if I could make a recording, then the feed would have to be working. Well, it looks like a lot of you must have wandered over to the web to see what was wrong, because I did post a bit up there saying, please try again. Don't lose me. So we definitely did lose a bunch of listeners right off the bat, and people are slowly coming back. I hope you guys are out there. Luckily, I did see there were quite a few downloads eventually, but boy, that made me so sad, especially after how much work I did on that episode. Oh, well. Last week, I was complaining about how Google is so lame because they came out with a proprietary video format, and they said that you can't even buy a video from them if you own a Mac. I thought that was really lame. Well, listener Bill wrote to me with a couple of things, one of which was that Google just came out with a video player for the Mac. Yay! We get to play too. He said that thanks to my podcast, he found out about this service and downloaded the Windows XP version. He was excited that they had the CBS shows because he's a big fan of New York CIS and saw that they were offering some recent shows. And he was also quite excited to find out that they had some of the Star Trek series. Well, this is a man after all my own heart. I'm pretty sure it's a prerequisite that to be a geek, you've got to love Star Trek. Actually, for Father's Day today, I gave my husband in every episode of Star Trek that Q was ever in. I thought that was really cool. So he's actually in three different versions of Star Trek. So I love anything Q is in. I love that character. Anyway, back to listener Bill. One thing that was confusing for Bill and I at first is that it appears that when you buy a video from Google, you can only play it when you're connected to the internet, because it downloads a link back to Google in a very small file that it downloads to your disk. However, we hunted around a bit on our hard disk, and we discovered that even though they give you that small file, when you open it in Google Video Player, it does actually download the file. On the Mac, it puts it in your movies folder, and evidently it does the same in Windows XP. I did notice when I first opened the file that it quickly flashed up a message about how it would take a little while to create the movie. I downloaded the atomic bomb test, which was 53 seconds long, and the file that downloaded was a GVP, I guess that's Google Video something file, which was only 760K. But when I opened it, it buffered for a while, and when I and then I was able to play it in Google Video. Then I looked in my user/movies folder, and there was the movie at 8.3 meg. Speaking of Google Video, there's a really funny but disturbing video out there that's free. Do a search in Google Video for laughing babies, and you'll find that there's this woman from the South. She's lying back in bed with four, count them, four babies all the same age. So she's got quadruplets, and they look identical. Every one of them's dressed the same, and their faces look identical. Well, the dad who's filming is evidently doing something hysterical because these tiny babies are just laughing their heads off in unison at it. It's kind of creepy sounding after a while because the babies just keep laughing together. And they finally subside, and then the mom goes, "Do it again." That's how I know she's from the South. And she said, "Do it again." And then the dad makes this funny whoo-whoo noise, and the kids go nuts. And these are little babies, too. These are like, maybe 3 or 4 months old. It's really, really funny in a kind of creepy, disturbing kind of way. Anyway, listener Ina wrote in about how she was frustrated with her Windows computer, so she convinced her husband to let her get a Mac instead, hoping it would be easier for her. Well, Ina, here's the deal. All computers are hard. They don't work like you expect them to, even Macintoshes, and they expect you to know so much more about them than you ever really wanted to know. I mean, seriously, do you check to see what operating system your TV is running before you buy it? You don't care, do you? You just want it to let you do what you want to do. I do believe that over time this will get easier for you, but whatever you do, stop thinking that you have a problem, that, you know, you refer to yourself as technologically impaired. But if this stuff was well written, you wouldn't feel that way now, would you? I mean, does your toaster make you feel stupid? No. So, since you've already figured out how to send me this mail and how to make the text italics in blue, I'm suspecting you're actually much better at this than you give yourself credit for. One of the problems that listener Ina had, and luckily I'd had the exact same problem, do you ever get an email from someone where it's got some text and then suddenly it's chopped off? And it always kind of looks like maybe it's HTML mail to me, but I can't see all of the text. And I get it from one particular friend pretty frequently. Well, she was trying to figure out how to find the rest of that email. The only way I figured out how to find it is if you forward that email, it'll actually show all of the text. If you reply, it won't. But if you do a forward and then just don't forward it to anybody, you can't actually read it. So listener Ina gave that a try, and it worked for her. So that was kind of nice to solve that problem. One thing I did want to let you guys know is there's a great website out there made just for switchers, so I thought you might get some use out of it. People who've moved from Windows to the Mac. The site is called surfbits.com, and it's headed up by a great guy named Tim Verporten. I'm not a switcher myself, so I'm not sure whether it's going to help everybody or not, but I've heard a lot of good things about it from other switchers. There's also an author named David Pogue who writes for the New York Times. Oh, I think it's the New York Times, somewhere in New York. Anyway, he's a fantastic author, and he's written a book that he calls the Mac OS X Missing Manual, basically the manual that should have come with the computer. I put a link in it from Amazon.com in the show notes. So anytime, Ina, you have a question, give a holler. We're all in this together. After I sent that information to Ina, it was pretty funny. She wrote back and she said, "Oh, I'm so glad to hear David Pogue's book is good," because she was in the Goodwill store the other day, and she found David Pogue's book and thought, wow, maybe that'll help me out. And she bought it, but she hadn't opened it up yet. So she bought it at Goodwill for, I don't know, a dollar or $2 or something like that. So that was kind of fun. I think that's going to help her out a lot. Listener David bought a new MacBook, and of course he could not resist the black one. He told me he has two MacBook Pros and a MacBook, plus another laptop that I think is a PowerBook. He's just surrounded by Macintoshes. He says he needs a 12-step program to get out of this. Anyway, he sent me a few notes about how much he likes the MacBook. So I thought I'd read you a little bit of his review. He said that he found that the MacBook runs significantly cooler than the MacBook Pro, and he's also very pleased with the battery life. The MacBook uses a 55-watt lithium polymer battery, which is rated for up to 6 hours. Obviously, nobody actually gets that, but it's a useful number in comparison. And the comparative number on the 15-inch MacBook Pro is only 4.5 hours. Now, my first assumption was that it was because the MacBook Pro has a bigger screen than the MacBook, as 15 inches versus 13.3. But I checked the specs on the 17-inch MacBook Pro, and it's rated at 5.5 hours. What's up with that? What a jip. I would love to have 5.5 hours of battery life. All right. Enough of my problems. I know you don't have any sympathy for me anyway, but it is great news for the MacBook buyers that it gets that great battery life. The 2 gigahertz version of the MacBook, upgraded to an 80 gigabyte drive, makes it equivalent to the 2 gigahertz MacBook Pro, and it's $1,350 US versus the MacBook Pro at $2,000, so $650 cheaper. For that, you get a smaller screen, the 13.3 versus 15.4, which can actually be a good thing in some circumstances. It's easier to lug around in a backpack, it's easier to fit on a plane, things like that. The MacBook is actually 0.4 pounds lighter, but it's made of the more durable polycarbonate, and it's only 0.08 inches thicker. The one disadvantage of the MacBook is that it has shared memory between the graphics and the main system memory, but that's really only a major concern if you're playing games with shaded images flying around. I'm thinking that if it was my own dollars involved, I'd go for the MacBook versus the MacBook Pro. Of course, when I'd get in the store, I'm sure I'd go to the higher model MacBook, and then, of course, I wouldn't be able to live without the black one, and I'd probably end up spending $1,500 before I upgraded it to 2 gigabytes of RAM and 120 gig hard drives, so I'd be up to about $2,200, but that's me. I'm sure you have a lot more self-control. I really do think if you're in the market for a great laptop at a competitive price that can run Windows alongside Mac OS X, I'd sure consider the MacBook today. You've probably heard of Google Mashups. That's where people take the Google interface and add their own interesting content to it. My buddy Ron told me about a cool little site/application called pinthemap.com that allows you to attach text to a pin that you can add to a location in Google Maps, and then it gives you a URL to email to people so they can see your pinned map. So if you wanted to send a map of your house, you could actually put a little pin where your house is, put in the little instructions, whatever you wanted to type into the little bubble that comes up, and then you could send that to people so they'd be able to easily see where you live. I gave an example in the show notes showing the location of the Hermosa Beach Pier. If you click on the link in there, you could see it. It is a little clumsy moving around in pinthemap.com. You can't just slap in an entire address like you can in Google Maps. You kind of have to zoom in on the area and push in the pin yourself. And you can't put in more than one pin, which would be kind of handy to show a couple of things. But it's kind of fun. Check it out at pinthemap.com. So a couple of weeks ago, I told you about the sudden motion sensor in the MacBook Pros and about how some people have been writing interesting little programs to use the information from the sensor to do silly and sometimes useful things with their MacBook Pros. Did you hear that? My current favorite is Mac Saber, which turns your Mac into a lightsaber. I couldn't demo it before, but I'll do a demonstration now. This is the one thing that won't really be as cool as seeing it, but I'll try to make this work. So imagine me sitting in my fake studio, now my real studio, swinging a $2,000 laptop around just to make you laugh. Okay, get ready. Here goes. All right, I'm going to lift it up. And I'm swinging it to the side. Tilt it the other way. back and forth, up and down, right and left. Woo! I win. Anyway. Research Department Niraj sent me a site that has collected many different hacks that use the motion sensor input. It's available at mexicanpictures.com/headingeast. And of course, I've got a link in the show notes. They have references to hacks that trigger video capture if your Mac is disturbed, variations on SmackBook, that's the one that changed the desktop in a visual, in a virtual desktop environment if you smack your book, HID outputs, that stands for Human Interface Device. If you can get the HID, the output as an HID, that means you can use the book's motion to drive a game. Kind of a cool idea. They also have 3D visualizers for your MacBook's orientation and more. It's going to be fun to watch where this goes over time. The silly stuff is first, but I'm guessing some useful stuff will happen eventually. Well, you can thank my buddy Ron for this next one. What happens when you combine 200 liters of Diet Coke and over 500 Mentos mints? It's amazing and completely insane. I put a link to this video in the show notes at epbird.com. It's the first part of the video demonstrates a simple geyser. And so what happens is you drop Mentos into a bottle of Diet Coke and it just shoots up in the air like 20 feet. I mean, it's this huge geyser. But so they show you that as one of their early experiments that they do one of them. And then the second part shows just how extreme it can get. Over 100 jets of soda fly into the air in less than 3 minutes. It's a hysterical and spectacular mint-powered version of the Bellagio fountains in Las Vegas, brought to you by the mad scientists at epbird.com. That's EEPYBIRD.com. I know, the premise of my podcast was that I would give you useful tools that actually solved a problem you had, but I really am true to that premise here. Who would say that we don't laugh as often as we should? That's a problem, and I think if I can help in my little way to solve it, I feel I've done good work. I defy you to watch this video and not think to yourself, how long did it take two grown men to set up this ridiculous stunt just to make me laugh? Enjoy. Listener Robert sent in this. Adobe's not happy with Microsoft and threatened court action. Apparently, the saber rattling had an effect, as Office 2007 will now ship without a save to PDF capability. But it goes even further than that, as Microsoft also plans on softening the Vista bundling requirements for its own XPS format, a possible Acrobat competitor. We've got all the details on this case, but in short, it looks like Microsoft blinked. If you want to read the full article about that, I've put it in the show notes. I saw it over at betanews.com. At first, I was gleeful that Microsoft was not going to do what Apple had been able to pull off for years, printing to PDF inside the operating system. But as I read the rest of this article, it looks more complicated than that. From the press releases that Microsoft has conducted, they're saying that while Adobe offers PDF as an open standard and does not charge companies like Apple or open source projects like OpenOffice, they want to charge Microsoft to be allowed to do it. The article goes on to point out that Adobe has been silent on the argument, so perhaps there's another side of the story. It is important to note that Microsoft is pushing this rival proprietary format called XPS. I sure hope that Adobe isn't taking a road that will push Microsoft to make them put in a standard that excludes other operating systems. You know, we all lose when that happens. That'll be interesting to see how that all rolls out. While we're on the subject, I thought I'd elaborate on Apple's instantiation of PDF printing. If you don't use OS X, or maybe you haven't discovered this, whenever you tell OS X to print something, one of the choices is PDF. That gives you a pull-down with a whole bunch of choices. Save as PDF, save PDF as PostScript, or my favorite, mail to PDF. So many times I don't want a copy of the PDF for myself, I just want to mail it to someone. I do this all the time with web pages and receipts I get, online web receipts. And that way the formatting doesn't get all screwed up and it's a little more immediate for them than asking them to click on a link. There are a bunch of other options I've never played with. You can compress or encrypt a PDF from there, save as PDFX, whatever that is, save the PDF in your iPhoto library, or save the PDF to your web receipts folder. Again, whatever that's for. I actually do have a receipts folder where I put web receipts. I wonder if they already built one in and I never knew it. I may be a small-minded person to revel in the failure for Microsoft, but it just tickles me a little bit that they haven't been able to pull this off. Well, I'm sure it's all lawyers arguing and sucking the life out of everything in reality. At the All Things Digital Conference, I did find a couple of interesting tools. The first one I wanted to review is freewebs.com. I had the luxury of a guided tour of Freewebs by the president and CEO, Shervin, I'm never going to pronounce his name, Peshevar. He was passionate about his product, which was really infectious. He created this site to allow anyone to create a website with no experience whatsoever. Basically, your mom can create it with this. There's two doors you go into when you start up Freewebs. The simple and the easy way, or I already know HTML and I just want to host my site for free. I chose door number one to test out these simple and easy methods built into this tool. I entered information on my for my full name, description of the site, and the category I wanted it to be listed in, computer/internet. Next, I had to choose the look from 33 templates. So they come out with 33 little boxes that show all these cool-looking different ways you can represent your site. And next to each one of them are little color bars that allow you to change the look from a color perspective, which was really, really nice. So quite a lot of options. I chose the waveform template and dark blue as the color option. Time to enter the site for the first time. But it says it's compatible with IE 5.5 or Firefox on the Mac and IE or Firefox on Windows. I'm using Camino, which is sort of a Firefox derivative, so let's go in anyway. The next section offers to let you add more features with a button that allows you to go see the site. The template is beautiful, but of course, I've got nothing in there. There's a really annoying blinking banner on the edit page at this point, the kind that flickers so much that you're sure it's going to induce some kind of epileptic fit if you're not careful. It's an ad for some garbage. I don't know what it was. Oh well, back to focusing on what I'm supposed to be doing. Add more features lets me choose web polls, counters, shout boxes, blog, web forms, albums, and guest books. Well, when I get into that page, it has even more different annoying blinking winner, winner thing going at the top. I wish they'd cut that out. I did eventually get to a point where I was in a page where the ad switched to ask.com, which was not blinking, and that was such a relief. I chose to add a blog next. They give you a quick paragraph on what a blog is, and then you're off and running. They have a lot of very intuitive formatting options, explanations if you hover over those options too. I was able to add a picture to my blog, upload it easily. It gave me options to wrap the text and to give it some padding so the text didn't bang up against the photo. I forgot to do the padding, and after the fact, I wasn't able to figure out how to change it. Creating this blog entry now changed my homepage to have a home button and a My Blog button under the banner. Ads were running across the top, but I was able to change the color so they blended in a little better and weren't quite so intrusive, and none of them were blinking. The very top left says Freewebs, followed by the site name, but evidently NoSilicast was longer than they wanted because I got NoSilicast... instead of the full name. But that's not a big deal because NoSilicast is printed huge in the banner right below it. But it was kind of an odd behavior thing. Not quite sure why it did that. I decided to try adding a page to the site, and I used the content from my recent post on the second half of the digital conference. I had to mess with the HTML links a little bit, but not much. This was also the first place that I noticed Camino was not working properly. The done or possibly save button had no text in it, but it was the only unlabeled thing on the page, and I couldn't find done or save anywhere else, so I figured out what it was. That was the point where I found an insurmountable problem with Camino and Freewebs. In order to access the pages I'd created, there were links to click on, but nothing happens in Camino. I switched over to Firefox, and it worked fine, so you really should take their warning seriously, and since they do Firefox, you can't give them too hard a time. So I worked in Firefox for the rest of the review. When I clicked on the homepage link to edit it, it took me to see what it looked like, but now I had no options to edit the page. This is the first time it wasn't really obvious what to do next, and there wasn't a link back to Freewebs to edit my document. I clicked on the FreeWeb's name in the upper left, but that took me back to their homepage with all the login options, and the other links like build a website all took me to ads for other services outside of FreeWeb's. That's when I realized that FreeWeb's had opened my site in another window, and the original window was still there with all the editing options. Maybe I'm just slow, but it tricked me up. I played around a bit with changing the picture for the banner, and that worked easily. It gave me the option to optimize the photo I chose for the web. That's a constant problem that people use photos that are very high resolution, and they take forever to print on screen, and you can't tell the difference between a low-resolution picture and a high-resolution one. The graphics did get kind of tangled up there. The text about optimizing the web was on top of the name of the file I was uploading and hanging kind of off onto the right onto the top of a button. It didn't stop the link from working. It just kind of looked, hinky. Next, I decided to figure out what a web form was, so I clicked on the big button for that. I think this part could benefit from one minor change that would make it work a little more intuitively. The good part is there's, again, a quick explanation of what this button does. It's a way to have a little form to allow people to submit an email to you. This sounded cool, but it didn't have an obvious way to start it. Turns out that you have to go over to the site manager, click add a page, then change the pull down to web form. I think pushing the button that says web form should have taken you straight there. I did figure it out, but it turns out that new accounts are essentially on probation for the first 7 days, so I wasn't allowed to play with it yet. That's all right. I can understand the need for this. I'll go back and play with it later. Next, I tried the photo album, and overall it worked very well with a couple of issues. I had the option to upload photos and again to optimize for the web, but this time the text falling all over it made the button really hard to actually hit upload. It took me 4 or 5 clicks before I got it to go. After uploading a picture, you're able to put a title and some text for the picture, but when it ended up in my album, none of that text shows, so I'm not really sure where it ends up. I thought there'd be a title up above and a caption down below, but there wasn't anything when I looked at it in the photo show. I put 3 pictures in, and I was able to intuitively, very intuitively, change the order. They had great, huge, green up and down arrows that were perfect. You just pushed on them and it went up, 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 down, down, down. It was really, really easy to do. I did discover that my earlier optimism about what optimize for the web meant was wrong. One of the pictures I loaded was a 4-megapixel file, and that's exactly how it got up there. I really had hoped that they were scaling them for people. It's kind of unfortunate because if this really is for newbies, they're not going to know how to shrink photos for the web. And the proliferation of higher-end, higher-resolution digital cameras will only make this problem get much, much worse. The last thing I did was add content to the homepage, and while it looks perfect in the editor page, the links work, no break symbol showing, the actual site had all of the HTML showing. I didn't know how to fix it since it looked great in the editor page. I waited a while, and I went back to the site, and it had magically fixed itself. I don't know. I know I hadn't hit refresh, so that wasn't it. It just kind of got better. I guess there's some interpreter running in the background that went through and fixed it. Oh, well, it's working now. I added a guest book just for fun, and it was instantly created, intuitive and easy like everything else. Overall, I'd say that the free web service is just about as easy as I can imagine to create a quick blog website with very, very low knowledge levels. With the few minor changes I suggested, it would be just about perfect. Check it out yourself at freewebs.com. If you want to check out the site I created as I wrote this, check it out at freewebs.com/nosilicast and let me know what you think by signing the guest book if you like. This next story just really tickles me for some reason. I don't know. I'm just so intrigued by it. Have you heard about this new ringtone the kids are passing around that only they can hear? Let me give a little bit of background on it first. It's a fascinating story. Turns out this guy in England had a problem with gangs hanging around outside his store. So he developed this 9-inch box that emitted a high-frequency noise that was only audible for teenagers, and it's really annoying to them. By emitting that noise in front of his store, the kids have stopped hanging around in front of his store, and shoplifting has even dropped. Well, now the tables have turned. The kids are taking in the same noise, and they've made it into a ringtone. The idea is that since only they can hear it, they could have their phones ring during class, and the teacher would never know. All right, so you're all wondering whether you can actually hear it, so I'm going to play it for you. I'm going to play it fairly short, though. I've got, I don't know, maybe a minute's worth of it, but I'm only going to put it in here for maybe 5 or 10 seconds because I really want to not hurt anybody who can hear it, because it's really, really annoying to the people who can hear it. I can hear it in my right ear. If I tilt my head down just right, I can get the sound to come out. I can hear it. But most people as ancient as me can't hear it. But trust me, if you're in your 30s or 20s, you'll be able to hear this. One caution I should be able to give, I can't swear that this is going to work right to put the file in here. So I've given a link to the real file in the show notes. But I converted it into iTunes as an MP3 and in order to be able to put it into GarageBand. And the strange thing is, a lot of people can hear it in iTunes when you can't hear the pure sound. So I think converting it into an MP3 made it a little more audible, got a little more noise around the signature, and so it's able to be heard. So if you can hear it and you're in your 40s, that's probably why. Anyway, I gave a link to it at download.npr.org. Or if you just do a search anywhere on the web for Teen Buzz, that's B-U-Z-Z dot MP3, you'll be able to find it and play it live there. So here goes. I'm going to put it in for just a few seconds. Okay, everybody hear that? I hope not. Anyway, it's kind of a, there's just something about the story that just really intrigues me. Another thing I found at the digital conference was I met the CEO of a company called Bellamax.com. That's Bellamax.com. And her company has developed a shareware photo editing program with some really good color correction capabilities. The software is called Upshot, and even though it's Java-based, it only runs on Windows right now. She assured me that the Mac version was being worked, but luckily I can switch over to Windows on my Mac to give you a preview. Even if you're not sure you need Upshot, they've given you an incentive to download it right now. If you grab it right now before the end of June, you'll get a full license that's good forever, that's free. After June 30th, the cost will be around $30. I usually like to do an in-depth review, but I haven't had a chance to play with all the features yet. But if I waited till I played with all the features, that wouldn't give you a good chance to pick it up while it's still free. So I'll give a quick overview and some early impressions to whet your appetite, and hopefully I'll get around to doing a full review later. The application is a rather large download for shareware, more than 80 megabytes, but it does include a 76-page PDF manual, which is really nice to have. I think going through the tutorials would be a really good idea for anyone new to the program, because it isn't exactly the most intuitive interface, but it might be worth the trouble to learn. The main thing the CEO talked about when she was telling me about her tool was the ability to adjust photos with tools no one else really has. I had a photo of a teammate on my son's soccer team, and I had worked and worked on it in Photoshop Elements, trying to brighten his skin tone without washing out the rest of the photo. He basically looked like he was in shadow. I really wasn't able to make it look the way I wanted to in Photoshop Elements, so I thought this would be a good test of Upshot. I brought the photo into Upshot, and with a single click to adjust skin tones, the picture was markedly better. I took a few other photos that I thought I liked the color on and ran their instant fix program, and their version definitely looked superior to the one I had. In addition to the fast fix that I was so pleased with, they have the usual buttons like rotate, flip, crop, straighten, brighten and contrast, color, sharpen, retouch, and explain. That's the help button. They're nice big buttons also for tutorials and help, along with slideshow, export, print, email, and order prints. The interface confusion I mentioned earlier had to do with how you actually get started with a photo. You can't just open a photo in Upshot. You have to add it to Upshot first. That confused me for a long time. I couldn't figure out how to get started, and of course, I didn't even crack the manual. They're very careful not to mess with the original photo, which is certainly admirable, but the problem is that after adding a photo to Upshot and editing it, you actually end up with three copies. You have the original sitting in your pictures folder, but then inside the pictures folder, there's a Bellamax folder that contains both your original and your enhanced copy, so two copies of the original plus the enhanced. Personally, I'm kind of a thrill seeker when it comes to my photos, When I edit photos, I edit right on the original. My problem is that I photograph nearly every minute of our lives, so I have 17 gigabytes worth of photos spanning a little over 5 years of digital photography. So if I kept the original on every one of those, I'd fill an entire hard drive. I carry all of my photos with me on my laptop, so I have to be a little more careful. Carrying three copies of the photo would just be crazy. That's wouldn't work at all. I'd have to just keep buying more and more discs. I do know, though, that most people like to protect their original, so having two is great. Having the original and the enhanced one is a good idea. But they better fix this in a later revision because it's not really adding any functionality, only chewing up disk space to have that third copy. Oh, man. I've just poked around a little bit more, and I just noticed that on one photo, I had done red eye reduction to fix it, and I had done the enhance, and it actually made a fourth copy of the photo. It was in a separate photo. It was a separate photo from the original enhanced in a folder called Original Red Eye. I did double check that all of these files were full size, by the way, not just some metadata. So they're really going to eat up your disk. This is really a concern. I also found a little minor bug in Upshot. I had to quit and go back in to get the directory listing to update, which was a little annoying. I would like to spend some more time poking around in this tool. It looks like they've got some excellent algorithms for photo enhancement, but could work on the interface and the storage issues of so many copies of your photo. In any case, if you want to get a free copy of the photo now, and a tool that's, I mean, not a free copy of the photo, that was silly, a free copy of the tool that's likely to become something pretty cool, check out Upshot at bellamax.com. Well, it's a good thing I run menu meters all the time. Remember a while back I had two runaway Skype processes that were hammering my system and really cranking up the heat? It just happened again. I opened up Skype about a half hour ago, and it was behaving normally. Suddenly my lap started to get really hot, and I glanced up at menu meters, and I saw that both processors were cranking away at like 90%+. Normally they sit, if I'm just goofing around a little bit, might see 20-30%. Well, I suspected Skype, so I quit it, but the meters did not drop. I used the pull-down and menu meters to pop up Activity Monitor, and there was Skype happily cranking away. I killed the process and Activity Monitor, and the meters immediately dropped down to normal levels, and the heat started to drop. If you haven't got it already, download Menu Meters from RagingMenace.com. I find it an invaluable tool. Just kind of fun to see what's, messing with your processors. Well, I really enjoy reading Walter Mossberg's technology reviews in the Wall Street Journal, and not just because he's really complimentary to the Macintosh. That doesn't hurt, but that's not the only reason. He recently reviewed both the MacBook Pros and the MacBooks, and wrote a great article, too, on how good boot camp is. But I was just wondering the other day why he had never written anything about Parallels, because, I'm obviously a big fan of Parallels. In fact, I think it's a much cooler solution than boot camp. I then realized that Walter doesn't ever review beta software, and Parallels was still in beta until this Thursday when it was fully released. And of course, Walt did a review as soon as it was released. He was extremely impressed with the product and really gave it his endorsement, which actually holds a lot of weight with the investment community. So this is great news for the folks over at Parallels who have put out such a great product and spent so much time and energy enhancing it during the few short months it was in beta. If you'd like to read Walt's article, head over to ptech.wsj.com and you can read that article, and you can also see all of his other archived articles as well. I had some fun with Walt at the digital conference. I noticed something funny about the website for the conference. You know that tiny little icon that's just to the left of a URL? Like if you're at Yahoo, it has a little red Y, or you're on podfeet.com and there's my two little green feet logo. Well, that icon is actually called a favicon. So to control what it looks like in different websites, on different browsers, you have to put in a favicon.ico file at your root directory of your website to control that look. Well, imagine the look on Walt's face when I showed him that Sun Microsystem had hijacked and put their own favicon on his website. If you've never seen the Sun logo, it's four purple S's kind of at angles to each other, forming kind of a diamond. Check it out at d.wsj.com. The logo's still up there as of when I recorded this. I asked the Sun guys about it and asked them if they knew why it happened, and they said they noticed that it actually happens a lot. They frequently go to websites that have nothing to do with Sun, and there's their Sun logo up there. I'm figuring Sun is doing something where if you don't put in your own favicon, they just put their own in there for you. I thought it was a pretty interesting hijack to pull off. You know, sort of subliminal advertising, don't you think? Well, that's got to wrap it up for this Father's Day edition of the No Silicast. Remember that feedback is always welcome. You can send email to allison@podfeet.com or leave voice recordings now at my new Gmail account, nosilicast@gmail.com. I've been getting scads of great email from people, and I love it. Just keep it coming. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.